There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 313. Short intro this morning, because right now I'm in Tacoma, Washington, and I had to do radio all morning, and I haven't eaten today, so the fact that I am starving is your gain in the way of not going long on this intro. So I would remind you that we're going to be performing at SF Sketchfest at sfsketchfest.com in San Francisco next weekend, which would be the 31st, 1st, and 2nd, I believe the 2nd of February is our live podcast there. So check that out online. I would like to thank Carbonite for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. Carbonite is online backup. If you're someone who kind of seldom backs up, or you don't, you're like, what's the worst that could happen? Well, losing all of your information is the worst thing that can happen, and it sucks it hard when that happens, because there's no one to punch but yourself. So backup, I recommend backing up on hard drives, but I also back up on the cloud as well. With Carbonite, your files are automatically and continually backed up, so use Carbonite. It's easy to restore them when you lose stuff, because machines do fail. They die. Sometimes you have to take them out back. Your better backup plan for home and small businesses, Carbonite. Plans start at $59 a year. Start your free trial today at Carbonite.com. Use the offer code Nerdist to get 2 bonus months with purchase. That's Carbonite.com, and enter the promo code Nerdist. Peter Farrelly is today's guest, a guy that I've kind of known, not super well, but certainly enough that I'd be like, hey, Pete, and he'd be like, Chris, how are you? And then we high five, and then probably go talk to other people. But he's great. I love Peter Farrelly as anyone who's ever worked with him will tell you that he's one of the nicest guys that you could meet. Just a nice, like, a regular dude who's made some fucking amazing comedies with some fucking amazing people. Movie 43 opens today. The day this podcast dropped. I probably don't have to justify that every time. You guys understand how this stuff works. But Movie 43 is sort of like a mega sketch movie, kind of in the vein of Kentucky Fried Movie. And that opens today. We talk a lot about it in the podcast, so you'll hear more about it. And also some amazing facts about some of those comedies that I mentioned before, things I didn't know. There's some good Bill Murray stories in there. This podcast has it all. So here we go. You know, in retrospect, I guess it was about the same as a normal intro length, so I didn't really shorten it that much at all. And I'm actually making it longer by continuing to talk now. I'm awesome. All right, here we go. The Nerdist Podcast, number 313, with the wonderful and kind and hilarious and cool Peter Farrelly.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Peter Farrelly, welcome to the podcast. Pete, you are a guy that I have had contact with over the years. I think the first time I met you, I was doing a radio show in Los Angeles. You were promoting There's Something About Mary, and you came on and you were like, guys, I know this sounds crazy because I made this movie, but there's insane shit that you've never seen before in this movie. There's like a cum glob and hair. Like, you started going through all this stuff and like, how crazy is this movie? And then, of course, I saw it, and I was like, holy fuck, he was not kidding.
Yeah,
this
movie I remember was those days, actually, before it came out, because it did not get a good push, by the way. It didn't open, you know. The movie only opened to 13.
Sleeper.
Yeah. And back then, of course, you could not open and hang in the theaters a little longer and hopefully find an audience. Really hard to do now. But I remember, like, going on these shows saying, guys, you got to watch this thing. I'm telling you, it's really funny.
That was before social media.
Yeah. Yeah. You had a partner, right?
I did. My old radio partner, Cortland Cox.
And then I remember a few years later, I got a song that Charlie Wessler sent me on that you had done, "Hard and Firm."
Yes.
And that was one of the most hilarious songs in the world. I thought that was just an incredibly funny song. And I said, okay, we got to get this in. I tried to get it in like three movies. We finally did put it in The Three Stooges,
awesome.
As you know. And then at the very end, it got cut. Because it was at the end of the movie, we waited too long for the song to come out. In the movie, everybody's like impatient by the end. They're like, come on, get on with it. But anyway, it's in the DVD.
Oh, well, that's awesome. Thank you. I'm so glad.
Yes, it is.
What's the song?
Funkhauser.
Oh, yeah.
Which was largely a Furman production because he just had this idea that it's like the old Sessions blues guy.
With Archibald and the drums.
That's exactly right. Basically calling in, bring in, and it just starts getting really crazy.
I love that song.
Bring in a robot, put a force field around the,
By the way, why did you call it Hard and Firm? Why don't you just call it the Hard-Ons or something?
Because my last name is Hardwick and his is Furman.
I know, I'm kidding.
Oh, God damn it. See what happens when you have funny people on the show.
His name?
This is a new thing that I'm trying where someone poses a rhetorical comedy question, but then I try to answer it with real information.
I like that. Basically,
I've become Twitter. It's like no matter how sarcastic you think you're being on Twitter, someone's like, here's the reason. You're like, God damn it, that was a joke. Come on, guys. Fucking back me up.
But when you guys recorded, you were the only one that got headphones, right?
I was the only one that got headphones. Mike was not allowed headphones in Hard and Firm, and that's why it's so amazing. He guessed all of it. He guessed it.
You know, that's one of the horrors of doing interviews is that, sarcasm is lost on it. Like, you know, I actually think of this sometimes. I'm not religious, but I do believe there's a bigger picture out there. There's something going on that we don't see, we don't know. Some kind of a, let's say, God, okay? And I wonder, does God have a sense, like, was God going to, like, get, like, oh, no, I was kidding. Like, if you do die and they play it back, they say, remember this joke? I'm like, no. Or remember you said this? I said, no, that was a joke. I mean, I did say that, but that wasn't real. That the whole point was that it's how absurd that is.
But yeah, I made the world in 7 days. No, that was a joke. Like, oh, well, it only took me 7 days.
I
always hate that when a comedian dies and they, like, at the Laugh Factory, it'll say, make God laugh. But the concept of making someone laugh means that you're surprising them, and you cannot surprise an omnipotent being.
Yes.
So that always puts me
in. I'm hoping that. But I did, like, we just did an interview last week with the New York Post, this woman in the New York Post, about this movie 43 that's coming out. Movie 43, which is just like a Kentucky Fried movie. Outrageously, like,
sketch movie. It's like a
sketch movie with all big stars, all different writers, by the way, all different writers, directors, stars, everything. We produced it, but with Charlie Wessler and John Panatti. But we were joking around with the woman on the phone, and she's talking. Did anybody say no? I said, yeah, George Clooney told us. By the way, I don't know what the language
is. Anything you want to say. Yeah.
Okay, I said, yeah, George Clooney told us to fuck off. Now, George Clooney didn't tell us to fuck off. He just passed, like people do in a movie, right? And then other things like, how did you get all these stars? We said, we guilted them into it. You know, like, the article comes out, and she says, these stars did not want to do it. They were guilted into it. George Clooney said, fuck off. When they like, and just told it, like, without the sarcasm part, which is horrifying.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that, like, you realize, like, oh, okay, I can't do press anymore because, you know, they just take whatever you say and switch it around. It was complete. And we were all laughing, having a good time.
There's no format or font for sarcasm. And I, for the longest time, have wanted to pitch reverse italics. So anything that leans to the left, sarcasm.
I like that.
I like to think that if there's a keyboard where when you press the keys harder, they kind of get bigger and smaller. So it's like, oh, I get it.
Yeah.
That's actually a really good idea. Yeah. Like a sensitive. Yeah.
Patented.
What? You already patented that?
Just now. I could just say it and then it's done.
No. I think it is.
Yeah.
You have to run through
it's done.
Paperwork.
Here's the product.
They would say, they'd come back and they see the date on this. They say, well, he was the first one to do it.
I'm going
to
mail this podcast to myself. And that's a poor man's. No, I'm not going to open it.
Okay.
No,
it doesn't matter. No matter how much, no matter what you say, Glee will still steal it like they did with Jonathan Coulton.
Are you familiar with the website Fark?
Yes, of course. Fark is a pillar of the internet.
Yeah, I believe I was the first person ever to use that word. It was in my book, The Comedy Writer, where this woman calls this guy a fark. She goes, you're a fark. He goes, a what? A fark. He goes, what's a fark? A dog, thank you, idiot. It was what she called a dog.
Cock.
Penis.
Oh.
A FARC, F-A-R-K. And so I went back and I sued them. No, I'm kidding. But I do claim, I think I introduced the word.
Wow.
But they, by the way, just to be clear, he didn't pick it up because of that, because I actually looked into it, and he had been using it for another thing.
Well, Fark's been around for a really long time, yeah. And they used to, like, Fark was sort of the one of the original places where people would go, and like there were a lot of memes came out of a Fark.
Right.
A lot of classic memes you would see came out of Fark.
Have memes been around that long? Because I just got into the whole meme thing in the last like 6 months. I'm like, memes.
Oh yeah.
I think that's how long they've been around. I can't ever tell anymore with
since,
internet.
Since
internet
the internet
time is weird.
Yeah. I don't know how soon we started calling them memes. I think the word meme came from Richard Dawkins.
Yeah,
I think
Richard Dawkins,
the guy who wrote the God Complex. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant the host of.
No, that's Richard Dawson.
Family Feud.
Yeah, the host of Family Feud didn't do really anything in internet related.
No, I was surprised.
I know. You'd think
I was.
He's been waiting. The
I don't
entire
know a lot
time.
About the internet.
You'd think that the anchor of Match Game.
Yeah.
Actually, no. He started 4chan.
Huh? Yeah, Richard Dawson. Yeah. Richard Dawson started 4chan.
Yeah, exactly.
Number one meme. Top 10 memes on the board.
Meme's a French word, right? Meme, like mimeograph.
Like yeah, like mimetic. It's short for mimetic.
Yes.
So I assume that it's probably it probably has some sort of other language in origin. Perhaps a romance language like French or Latin.
I'm sure the internet will let us know right after this podcast.
I don't think they will.
No?
I don't think they
will. Something that they hold so dear?
Yeah, I don't think what I've discovered about people on the internet is they go, you know, that guy will figure it out. I don't need to throw my 2 cents in there.
Yeah.
And everyone's not the worst person since Hitler. Just what the internet loves to tell you.
It does come up a lot.
Do you feel like, well, you guys, give me a little background
on. If all you ever learned about or knew about Hitler was what you learned from watching the History Channel.
Yes.
You'd think he was some kind of raving lunatic. You
know? It's almost like.
It's crazy.
I always like to imagine the History Channel as like a guy that you know and you go over to his house and he just only has Hitler DVDs. You're like, why? You only show these things when people come over? Yeah, I can't get enough. That's weird.
Do you think History Channel ever got excited in a weird sort of way where they're like, oh, we've just exhausted every Hitler angle ever? And then someone's like, we just figured out there were like 20,000 more people he killed. Great! Oh what a this is great news! Yeah. Now we can make another series.
And they exhausted it again, or like, well, we can find out how much Hitler memorabilia is worth if you bring it into a pawn shop. Yeah. Perfect.
And then Hitler in space. Always in space.
Hitler Wars, where it's just basically finding Hitler memorabilia.
That was World War II.
I guess that was. Yeah. I guess that was just World War II.
Yeah, for the Pacific, they were all calling it the Hitler Wars.
That happened.
And it was just like confessionals with Rommel. Well, the fuel is very, very cranky today. It's like all the OTFs to camera. What is the history of the Farrelly brothers? How did you guys say? First of all, why do you want to direct a movie with another person? And second of all, when did you guys start?
Well, we were both salesmen, ne'er-do-wells, you know, like just massive failures in our lives definitely into our mid-20s. I was a salesman for a shipping line in Boston, and my brother was selling round beach towels. He invented the first round beach towel.
That's
called
fantastic.
Sunspot. And the idea was that, you know, when the sun moves across the sky, rather than, you know, move your towel, you just move your body.
So then you become a sundial.
Turns out, people don't mind getting up, moving the towel.
Not the biggest deal.
They want to stretch.
Yeah.
And maybe they're going to the beach, so they just kind of shake it off a little bit. In any case, so we were both floundering.
Hard to fold, too, a round beach towel. Hard to fucking fold that up and make it right.
Yeah, but you can fold yourself up like a burrito.
But then the idea was, though, that that logos, you know, most logos are round. So you have Coke and you know, Budweiser and all the things. You figured, you know, all these companies would jump on board. They didn't.
I am surprised. I actually think that the round beach towel is it just one of those things where it's like green ketchup? Who wants that?
I don't know. They patented it. It was called Sunspot. They actually got the patent. The other thing is they weren't great businessmen, my brother and his buddies. You know, they weren't like the greatest businessmen in the world. So they were, you know, when you sleep till 2 and then get up and make like a couple calls and then go to the bar, you're not going to, you know, it's not going to like, you know, happen. And that's kind of...
You're basically cleaning up your throw-up with your sunspot surplus.
Yeah, a lot of that. So, anyway, it didn't work out. But anyway, in my mid-20s, I got the notion to start to write. I wanted to write, and I had the advantage of being a total you know, failure and everything, so nobody stopped me, basically. And I remember I at a premiere once, I had a friend of mine named Jimmy McDonald come up to me, and he went to high school with me. He was top of the class. He was captain of the hockey team, went to Yale, played hockey at Yale. I think he was a captain of the hockey team there. He did everything. And he said, man, you are so lucky. You had the ability to fuck up. He goes, because when you are a fuck up, the world is your oyster. You could do anything, and nobody's going to stop you. He said, like, if I'm on a path, I was, like, kicking ass. And if I said all of a sudden, you know what, I'm going to, like, go get a, become a waiter and start writing stuff. They said, no, you're going to law school or business school. Come on, man.
So you credit your success to failure.
Absolutely. And I, a few years ago, we did a, what do you call it, speech at a college. What's the end of the year speech?
Commencement speech.
Thank you. And at Roger Williams University in Rhode Island, and first thing I said was, how many people here graduated with honors? Everybody stand up who did. Let's give them a huge round of applause. Like, all right, that's spectacular. Now I'm going to talk to the rest of you. Because that's who we were. We're the 2.0 guys who are sitting there at the end of college thinking, what now? We're done. There's no way that we're going to recover from this. But you can, because now you have the world open to you. You could do anything. Like when I decided to write, you know, I remember telling my parents I was nervous about it, and they were just, go, good. You want to do something.
Yeah.
I remember when I started college, first week of college, I met with my advisor, and he goes, so what's your major? I said, I don't know. He goes, well, you have good math boards. How about accounting? I said, okay. I majored in accounting for 4 years. On that. Wow. And then I got out of college. My father says, so what now? I said, I don't really know. He goes, you're 22 years old. You have no idea. When I was 7, I knew I wanted to be a doctor. I became a doctor. You know nothing? I was like, you know, I was one of those guys, who, and a lot of my friends are, who really didn't decide or find what they want to do till at least mid-20s, and sometimes like late 20s, early 30s, even late 30s.
Yeah.
I have friends who woke up one day and said, God damn it, I wish I'd done this. And if they did go on at that point, you know, basically if you love something, you're going to do well at it.
Right. Well, I think there's sort of a thing where, you know, because particularly in stand-up, you know, most comics, with a few exceptions, don't really hit it until their 40s, because you kind of spend your 20s fucking around, and then maybe in your 30s you decide what you want to do, and then you spend your 30s really honing that, and then that takes like a decade sometimes to pay off. So
Louis C.K. is like, everybody's like, where's this guy been? You know, do you think he just got funny? No. How about Larry David? Larry David, you know, Seinfeld, he was in
Dangerfield.
His
40s. Dangerfield didn't make it till he was in his 50s.
Exactly. But if you stick with it and you love what you're doing, I mean, it's, you know, I wrote for, about 12 years before I ever got a movie made.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, but I was selling screenplays, so I was making money, but nothing was getting made. But I was happy as a clam. I will honestly say I was as happy then as I am since I started getting movies made. Like, I was having a nice life. It wasn't all about, if your identity is your job and the degree of success in your job, you're probably not going to be that happy. You got to have an outside life, and I did.
What was your outside life? Just fun?
You know, I was single and at the time, and I was, you know, running around, going to parties, hanging out, playing golf, just traveling. You know, I go, someone says, hey, you want to go to Miami this week? Yeah, let's go. I go there, you know.
Because you're screenwriting, so you can basically just
whatever you wanted to do. And then, you know, I met my wife toward the end of, you know, I want to clarify this because I didn't meet my wife after it happened. I met my wife a few years before things hit.
Yeah.
So I always look at that like, I think I wasn't ready for this to happen, honestly, because if it had happened when I first came out here, oh, man, I would have been doing blow and, you know, doing everything and just fucking up left and right. But by the time I met my wife, I was grounded. I had, you know, a good thing going, and then I could accept it.
It's pretty interesting that, you know, there are people who just make a very decent living just selling scripts to studios that never get made. Like, you know, someone can have, you know, 10 scripts at all the different studios and you've never heard of them. But they just keep, you know, like, one, I think once you're sort of in that system, then you can just keep churning out stuff to the studios.
To a point. I have to say, at the time we finally got our first movie made, I was really nervous that somebody was going to wake up and say, hey, wait a second, these guys have been doing this for years. Nothing's getting made. Maybe we go to somebody else. Because we sold 15 screenplays in 9 years, and we were making a good living, but nothing was getting made. But the way it would happen is this. You'd write a screenplay, and like Eddie Murphy would read it. He'd say, I love this. I want to do it. And then we'd meet with him, and everything's, this is unbelievable. It's getting made. And then he'd say, you know what? I'm going to direct it. And then the studio would say, they wouldn't say it, but you could see them like, oh, no, we don't want him to direct this. Because if he directs a movie, by the way, that's a year or two of his life. And he was the hottest guy in Hollywood at that time. He could make 3 movies in that time at least. And so they don't want him stopping to go direct a movie. So then they budget the movie that's probably like a $7 million movie, and they budget 55.
Oh.
You know, they're like, ah, no, you're going to need this, going to need that, it's going to be 55. And then Eddie's like, oh, okay, he loses a little enthusiasm, he goes away. And then we find someone else for it. And they say, I want to do it, but I need this director. And that director is making a movie. And then we finally get that director interested. He said, yeah, I do it with that actress, and she's that actor, and that actor is now making a movie. And it goes back and forth, and it's just like this nightmare where you cannot get everybody on the same page. And earlier you were saying, why would you direct a movie? Well, that's why. Because we knew we needed 3 things. You need a good screenplay, you need a star, and you need a director to make a movie. So if we cut out one of those, which is the director, then we only have to get the star. We write the screenplay. So we started telling, they said, who's going to direct it? So we are. And nobody blinked. Nobody questioned it.
Like, that's so fun. I love the idea that the whole movie making process is basically like a video game filled with side quests where it's like, acquire Eddie Murphy, acquire director, get $55 million.
Yeah. And okay. By the way, you got to do it on your own. And I have the best agency in town. I'm with CAA. I've been with CAA since 85 when I came out to LA. 85.
Oh, wow.
Richard Lovett, who runs CAA, and Adam Cain are my guys. And Richard, he was just made an agent at that time. And these guys are fantastic. They've done everything for me. They couldn't be better. I love CAA. However, you really have to... It's not just sitting back waiting for your agent to find.
No. I think a lot of people get tricked, especially because the larger agencies... If you don't really have stuff for them to do, they won't do it. And I mean, it's not necessarily that they don't want to. It's just they're momentum machines. And so you have to keep feeding them. And like you cannot rely on your agent to just do stuff, because they are more in the business of making deals and fielding offers. And you kind of have to build the thing for them to then take it over.
Or, you know, like I would be at a party and I'd talk to some other writer. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm up for a rewrite. What's the rewrite? This thing. And I'd call my agent. Hey, get me in for this rewrite. And then I'd read the script and you'd go in and do your pitch, or you're in a pitch meeting for a script and you can see it's not, their eyes are starting to drift. And then you see some other script on their table, like, what's that? And they say, oh, that's this other thing we're developing. And I call my agent, say, hey, get me in for that one. Like, literally, like, you got to hustle. You got to find, you got to keep it going. And, you know, as good as my agents are, and they are incredible, especially once you've got that everything going, like right now, you know, when you're trying to cast a movie, I can't call actors. It's extremely, unprofessional.
Yeah, you have to go through the representatives.
You got to go through it. Yeah. They know how to do it and who to do it with, and that's what...
Well, it's almost like... It's almost more unprofessional after you're successful. Before you're successful, you can kind of get away with like, hey, man, I'm doing this thing. Do you want to do it? All right, but you know, because you're who you are... It's got to come through the agent. What are you doing calling my client? You know?
They get mad.
Yeah.
And even if you know them, like, you know a guy, and I don't know that many guys, but, you know, because you make a movie, we live out of town, and you know, I don't, unless I made a movie with a guy, I don't really know them, you know, other actors. I don't know a lot of them, but the ones I do know, I'll call them, like, hey, you want to do this thing? And those call their agent, talk to them about it. And the agent will say, you're an idiot. You don't do that. You put them on the spot. Don't ever do that, you know?
Because no one wants to be the bad guy.
No.
Because you don't want to be the, you know, as the performer, you don't want to be like, oh, I don't want to do that. Or it's the performer's always like, sure, I mean, whatever. And then, you know, the agents are like, what are you doing?
Yeah. You know, when I was single, I was a guy, one of these guys, I had a really thick skin. Like, I could ask out 100 girls, and if 99 would say no. I'd be absolutely fine with it because I knew I played the numbers game. I knew like one was going to say yes, and it didn't bother me. It really didn't. I was just like, oh, okay. How about, do you want to go out? You know, and on and on and on. And that's sort of what you have to do in this business. Like, I have a thick skin because every movie we've ever made, more people have passed than have accepted it. You know, starting from Dumb and Dumber, where 300 different actors passed on it, and I never thought for 1 minute, honestly. I never thought, oh, you know what? Maybe this isn't very good. I just think, I now, by the way, sometimes it hasn't been very good, but in my head, I've convinced myself, you know, they're wrong, I'm right. I can take it, and I move on, and I do that always. I take a real Zen view of casting. No matter how many people say no, I'm thinking they're idiots. They're dead wrong. Keep plugging ahead.
So you're fine, like with critics and reviews, like none of that stuff bothers you. You just
critics. Okay, I'll be honest. I wish every time I was at a movie screening that at the end the people erupted, picked me up on their shoulders, and carried me out. You know, that's what my dream is. I don't read reviews because if there's one bad review for nine good ones, and by the way, we never have that ratio. It's way worse. if there was one, I only remember that bad review. It's because it's like, they're right. Yeah, they're right. I'm an idiot. Yeah.
That's interesting that you have the thick skin for the pitch process, but once it's already done.
I get mad at them. I get mad because I'm like, fuck you, you motherfucker. Like, you know, you work so hard. Like, you know, okay, great example is The Three Stooges.
Yeah.
Okay, The Three Stooges is probably the highest degree of difficulty movie we've ever made. And when we made that movie, everybody was saying, how are you going to do this? It's not going to come, it's going to be really cheeseball, right? And we cast the three best actors of all time for this thing. You know, just and Christy Mantopoulos, Sean Hayes, Will Sasso.
Yeah. Oh, I know Will. Will's great.
I promise you. You guys probably have not seen this movie.
I saw it. I watched it 3 days ago.
If the world... Everybody got a camera and got to make the Three Stooges movie, this would win. It would. These three guys are unbelievably good. Incredibly
good.
It's
the fucking Stooges. They're Stooges bits all over the place.
But we wrote all new material.
It's great. It's just in that voice.
And half of the reviews were off the charts. New York Times, LA Times, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, USA Today. Like, biggies. And they were like, this is so good. Like, you know, this is so hard what they did. And then half of them saying, what a piece of shit this is. And you, that guy, you want to pick up the phone and say, fuck you, you make the movie. You tell me how that movie could have been a better movie. Like, you could say, I'm not a Stooge fan. I get that.
Sure.
But those Stooge guys are, I will go to my grave believing that was as good as that movie could be. Those three guys, and I'm giving them credit. Like, my fear always was that two of them would be incredibly good and one would be so-so.
Well, wasn't the original casting like Sean Penn and Jim Carrey and Benicio Del Toro? Yeah. Or it was some crazy collection of people.
Yeah, and it was always like we had, and that's true. We went to all those people. We went to Russell Crowe. We went to Mel Gibson. We went to everybody. And the problem was, like a lot of times making movies, the studios are like, I don't know about this, and they didn't want to pay that money. It was too much money. So we had to go off and make a movie for a price, you know.
Sure.
And so we cast. And by the way, again, that's a good example. Sean Penn, okay, he's as good as it gets. Nobody would have been better than Sean Hayes in that role. Nobody. Sean Hayes as Larry would beat Sean Penn. And Sean Penn's, you know, it's just that nobody could beat this guy.
Well, there's a difference between going to see, oh, I want to go see what Sean Penn's doing with Larry, as opposed to, oh, I'm going to see a Stooges movie where, you know, like...
That's Larry.
When they're superstars, when they stunt cast like super, super, superstars, it's that sort of becomes the thing that the star of the movie rather than like, you know, you're never suspending your disbelief when you're watching Sean Penn. If you watch Sean Penn with Larry Harry, the whole time you're like, it's Sean Penn. You know, like you're not really watching the movie
at
that point.
Sean Penn would have been insane. He's great. He's such a good actor. But honestly, I just can't imagine anybody being better. Christy Mantopoulos as Mo, nobody knew Christy Mantopoulos. Nobody. And nobody could have done better. You could have had Mel Gibson. You could have had Russell Crowe. You could have had anybody. And Benicio, they're not going to beat Christy Mantopoulos. And by the way, the weird thing about Christy Mantopoulos, not a Stooge fan.
Oh, really?
No. He wasn't a guy who grew up like, oh, nothing a Stooge. He's a guy who can act, watched it, figured it out, came in, blew us away, and, you know, a real genius. Like, incredible. And Sasso, no, there's no better Curly out there.
Wow, yeah. those original... I was wondering if it would have been fun to was like doing films in the 30s like the internet now, or like, oh, this is a fun new thing. I guess this was catching on, you know, or did they really understand the film industry when they were making it at the time? Did they really understand the impact that it was going to have and, you know, and how important it was to the world? Or was it just like, oh, this is just a fun new medium we're playing in?
I don't know.
I don't think they were getting paid to have that weight to it. Like, it's like a lot of actors back then weren't getting the money that they get, like, you know, now. You had to, like, have your own studio.
No,
to, like,
but I
be
think it
money.
Was kind of like the old studio system is currently what, like, the YouTube system is now, where you have, like, these, like, studios and, like, people are under contract with, like, you know, channels.
Yeah.
And they have, like, they're just working for that channel all the time. And then it's like a studio system where, like, you're on an MGM contract now. You do... You know, I want to throw 40 projects at you, and you do 40 projects.
But there, it also, because there was nothing like that, whereas, you know, YouTube, we have TV, we have movies, we got this, right. We got that. Like, to see somebody on the big screen all of a sudden must have made it feel magical. Yeah. And you must, and godlike, you know, I think the stars then were probably, they seem more accessible now. And also, we see their flaws now.
Yeah.
Because everybody, you know, there's so many, you know, media outlets, they're killing them. Left and right, they just build them up to bring them down. And back then, I don't think they brought them down. They protected them.
Except
now
for Fatty
everyone's
Arbuckle.
Fatty Arbuckle.
Yeah,
everyone's Fatty Arbuckle.
Someone had to take it.
Yeah.
Everyone's Fatty Arbuckle.
Our society has become poor Fatty Arbuckle.
Yeah, it is.
Dumb and Dumber was one of those, is a movie that I think the only way that movie could have worked was the way that you made it, because it always just sort of rode the edge of like, wait a minute, and like, oh, fuck, that's hilarious. Like, it so could have, in the wrong hands, that movie could not have worked. But you guys managed to, how do you take that kind of, you know, almost over the edge kind of slapstick stuff, but then just keep it together and make it work?
Well... Again, it was a good thing in the sense that we couldn't get it made for 5 years. And during those 5 years, we just kept the script kept getting better and better and better. And to the point where I had friends that who we'd go out at night, hang out. And, you know, when we come back to the apartment two, three in the morning, they literally would say, hey, Pete, would you read Dumb and Dumber to us? This is, you know, long ago. And because he hasn't heard it, this guy. And I would sit there and I'd read the whole thing for an hour and a half. And that's the guy's honest truth. And they'd be sitting there toasting him up, listening to him, just dying, you know. And during every one of those readings, you hear something. Like you say, oh, this part's a little weak. I find myself rushing through this area. There must be something wrong there.
Yeah.
And I would mark it. I'd say, go back to that. Look at that. Why am I, like, because you knew the good part.
Well, that's really interesting. I never thought about when you're reading a script and you're like, oh, I'm rushing through this part.
Yeah. Oh, that's, I tell people, read it out loud to people because you know the good stuff. The good stuff, you are so happy. You're savoring it. You got good material. And then you get to a part and you know there's another good part coming up in a few pages and you want to get to it. And you're finding yourself. And so they go out the door and they come by and this thing, the lady says this and blah, blah, blah. You're rushing through it. That's a problem. If you're rushing through it, stop, think about it, figure it out.
Well, also the other thing about Dumb and Dumber, which could have been catastrophic, was that was the movie where Jim Carrey got like $7 million or something, right? So it's like he came off of Ace Ventura, this insane sleeper hit, and then all this. I mean, you know, people in movies always made money before, but that ushered in the era of people getting 7, 10, 15, 20. Like Jim Carrey was sort of the first. Where they were really talking about that. Oh my God, this guy, this comedian.
Yeah.
I mean, they, you know, they've sort of, you know, the guy from In Living Color who seemingly came out of nowhere. Like, meanwhile, you
the
know,
white
he's,
guy.
Yeah. Meanwhile, he's been,
the,
you know, he's
the
been,
guy from Duck Factory.
Duck Factory. Yeah. The guy who's actually been around at that point for over 10 years.
Yeah.
But he, you know, when a movie gets that kind of like, oh, now there's big money, everyone, you know, it goes under a microscope and it still worked.
Okay, well, that's an interesting story because that movie, after 5 years, Richard Lovett, my agent, gave me the best advice I ever got. He said, Pete, okay, you're sending it out to people and you're saying, we're trying to get the movie made. He goes, from now on, when you send it out, you say, we're making the movie. Because when the movie's getting made, they perk up. They don't want to miss it. If you say we're trying to get it made, they're thinking, oh, you need me to get it made? Everybody thinks so little of themselves. They're thinking, if you need me to get it made, it must be a piece of shit.
But what do you say if we're going to make this movie? And they go, where?
That's what I said. I said, so how can I say I'm making the movie? He goes, just, you're making the movie. I said, how, what does that mean? He goes, do you have 10 grand? I got like 8. He goes, make it for 8 grand. Just make the movie. It's been done. You do it for $8,000. So in your head, you're making the movie. You're not lying. You're telling them we're making it. And when we started saying, hey, look, we're making this movie, all of a sudden people started paying attention.
That's mostly crazy.
Yeah, and the studios, we had these guys who were the Pettis brothers in Washington, D.C., who had financed a couple of the Coen brothers early movies. We sent it to them, and they read it, and they were great guys, and they said, yeah, well, you know what? We'll give you $100,000. And we're like, oh, my God, it's a movie now. It's a real movie, $100,000. It's a big, big movie now. And so we had $100,000, and then New Line read it, and they knew they said, yeah, we'll give you $1,000,000. And we called the Pettises. We were like, it felt horrible because the Pettises had gotten the ball rolling. We were like, hey, guys, these guys are going to give us $1,000,000. I don't know what to do here. They go, God bless. Go ahead. Great. Oh, wow. They couldn't have been cooler. Nicest guys in the world. But so now we had $1,000,000 to make the movie. We were going to do a movie. Then Jim Carrey read it, right? And the budget got up to, well, they offered Jim Carrey. He had made Ace Ventura, but it wasn't out yet. And they offered him like, I'm trying to remember, it was like $200,000 to do the movie. And Jim said, no, I want $300,000. And they said, no, it's $200,000 or nothing. And then Ace opened. And it was number one.
So then he gets a call back. Then Nick Stevens at UTA gets the call. Who was his agent?
Yeah.
Gets the call and go, okay, that 200, I think that's going to have to be $7 million.
No, this is what happened exactly. He goes, they call and they say, okay, we'll give you the 300. He goes, no, I want 500. The movie's number one. We want 500 now. They say, you're not getting 500. We'll give you 400. No, we want 500. The next week, the movie's still number one. Okay, I'll give you five. No, I want 750. 4 weeks in a row, that movie was number one. And finally, it was $7 million. And that's exactly what happened. They could have had him way cheaper, but they kept coming just short. And his agents, to their credit, said, no, we're holding off. And then after the fourth week, all of a sudden, it's seven. He got seven. The movie was made for 16.
Oh my God!
Yeah. And by the way, they didn't want Jeff Daniels. I love Jeff Daniels.
Yeah.
Jeff Daniels is a god. And one of my all-time favorite movies is Something Wild.
Mm-hmm.
Something Wild.
Melanie Griffith.
It's a masterpiece. It's a total masterpiece. It's the movie I've seen more than any movie in the world. It's Jonathan Demme, and it's just incredible. It's Ray Liotta's first movie, I believe. And Melanie, and it's just a spectacular movie. So I knew how good he was from that movie. I'd seen him in other things, but we said, we want him. They said, no, we got to get a comedic actor. And we're like, what does that even mean? Like, he's a great actor. He's not writing it. He could do anything. And they said, finally, we got Jim Carrey. He said, Jim, you gotta realize this is the guy. Jim Rell with him. He said, no, that's my guy. I want him. So he said, no, Jim backed us, said, we want Jeff Daniels. And at that point, the studio, I want to say they offered him like $50,000 to do the movie. And knowing Jim's getting seven, and he took it.
Oh, what?
Said, okay, I'll do that. They were just trying to scare him away, and he just, no, fucking do it. But he got a back end. He ended up seeing money, you know, down the road, a lot of money.
Jeff Daniels seems like one of those guys that's just, he's an actor. He likes to work. He likes to act. Like, he disappeared into the Midwest and opened a theater.
Yeah.
It's like he just loves the craft of acting, and he loves being, you know, and he's, I don't think I've ever, like, if you said Jeff Daniels to someone, I can't imagine anyone going, fuck that guy. They'd be like, he's fucking cool. Like, he just seems to do what he wants to do. And that's a very commendable path.
Yeah, and when we hired him again, we had never directed anything, and I feel like I've told this story a lot, but we hadn't directed a commercial, a video, nothing. Hadn't been on a movie set except for one day David Zucker let me on a set, and I just kind of hung in the background.
Which movie?
It was one of the Naked Gun movies.
Okay.
And when we hired him, we had a talk. We said, hey, listen, when we get to the toilet scene, you're going to do it, right? Because we were afraid, you know, he's like, yeah, I'm in. And then when you get to the toilet scene, he's like, I'm not doing that. Because that was kind of like, at the time, nobody had done anything like that. And it was more embarrassing than it would be today. And he said, no, I'm going to do it. And he did do it, to his credit. He did everything we asked. But I remember on the set, he's a great guy. He's very quiet, nothing like his character. He just sits there. He's a sweet guy, nice guy, but kind of quiet. He sits and reads books on the sidelines. And we'd be sitting there setting up a shot, and I'd look over at him, and he'd see, like, we know nothing. We're like, I'm asking, like, the guy says, what lens do you want? I said, I don't know, put a lens in. Let me see what it looks like. And I'm looking at through the monitor. I said, yeah, okay, what lens would you put in to make the people look closer? And they change lenses. I said, yeah, that's the lens. And he would look up. He'd be reading a book, and he'd look up and just kind of give me like a little eye roll, like, holy shit, what the hell am I, did I get into? But he never, ever said a word.
He's reading like Being in Nothingness. All right, now then.
He was the greatest.
What is Bobby doing this whole time while you're swapping out lenses?
No, we're discussing it. Well, the one thing that we did.
Does people look closer? Yes.
Yeah. Do they look closer to you? Yeah, they are. They are closer. And by the way, literally the week before we were making it, I was at a dinner, and there was a director sitting next to me, and I'm trying to remember who it was. He'd done a few movies, and he said, now listen, just remember, I said I'm starting this movie next week. He said, just get a lot of coverage, whatever you do, get a lot of coverage. I said, what was that? and he called his wife over, who was down at the table. He said, come here, tell her what you just told me. I said, what did I say? He said, I told him to get coverage. And what did you say? Well, what's coverage? I don't know, what's coverage? He goes, you all do different angles, you know, try to get a lot of different angles so you could cut it and say, oh, okay, yeah.
Oh, that's what, oh, you call that coverage.
Yeah.
I call that angling.
Yeah.
I just have my own vocabulary.
Oh, okay, Mr. More Fancy Shots. Pants with coverage.
Yeah. I didn't go to film school.
But we did, what we did do is when we started that movie, we were so honest with everybody except for the studio. The studio, we didn't tell them we don't know shit. But the DP, the director of photography, the first AD, everybody on the set, the grips, everybody down the road. So guys, we don't know what we're doing, but we wrote the script and we know what we're going to get for performance, but we need your technical help. We don't know shit. So, and we didn't pretend to know shit. Like, and everybody was very helpful because we weren't like the guys trying to act like we knew what we were doing, and we weren't. Then they let you fail. But we were just like, guys, we're desperate for your help here because we don't know, you know, really the first thing about doing this.
So what happened? So the movie actually is a hit.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden this first movie that you've directed is a hit and then what does that feel like? Or what do you, is it weird that, you know, all of a sudden you can do pretty much anything you want when you've been swimming upstream for so long?
It's an odd feeling because I'd been doing it for so long. It was 9 years in LA before we get the movie made. It wasn't like this great party feeling. It was more relief. It was relief. It was like, thank God it finally happened. And in fact, in my entire career, I've never had a pop the champagne moment because that movie opened at 17 million, which is good. But it could fall off the next week. You know, it could drop off, and it might end up making 35. Who knows? You don't know. And then the next week, it was still number one. It made 16. And the next week, it was 14. And the 13. You know, it's one of those things that hung around, and then all of a sudden, it's out 6 weeks, and you realize one day, like, hey, it's a hit. Same thing with Something About Mary. You know, all our movies, we've never had that $50 million opening where you just, you know, I'd love to have that someday, where you're popping champagne and you know it's a smash hit.
Yeah.
Never had it. They've all been nail biters. All been nail biters. So it's more relief than anything. It really was. But it also was perceived as a, you know, a Jim Carrey movie. And it was a Jim Carrey movie. It wasn't just perceived, but we were nothing. So it wasn't like we were getting offered all these things afterwards. We had to scramble around again.
Oh, that's really interesting. They basically credited Jim.
Absolutely. You know, and you know, we were just the first time guys. It didn't mean anything. And in fact, our second movie completely bombed. Kingpin. It did $25 million.
That's so good. Such a good movie.
That bombed?
Yeah, bombed.
Does it? But that movie, like today, still so today, good. You know, because my dad was a professional bowler. Uh-huh. And so people always say, like, what does your dad think of Kingpin? I go, well, my dad likes the movie, but he always says to me, like, well, it's a cute movie, but I used to hustle. That's not really how it went down. I'm like, yeah, Dad, I know. The Amish don't bowl on the tour. Like, what are you fucking thinking? Where are you going to suspend your disbelief? But Kingpin is another one of those movies, even though it may not, then that's surprising to me to know that, because I just assumed, like, oh, Kingpin, everyone knows Kingpin. You know, Bill Murray, Woody Harrelson, like everyone.
And there's a lot of, by the way, it was a painful thing because a week beforehand, the studio called, it was MGM, they called, they said, it's going to do 18 opening weekend. We're like, awesome, spectacular. And then about 3 days before that, 4 days before it opened, they said, yeah, it looks more like 13. I thought, oh, okay. Well, that's still good, you know. And then the day it opened, they said, it's going to do 8. And then it did 5.
Oh, what?
It did 5 opening weekend. It did 1.6 or 7 the first night. It did 5. And then the next morning, first of all, you're devastated because you never see it coming. You love the movie. It seems so good. And yet, all of a sudden, it's a flop. And the reviews weren't great. You know, you got great reviews from Siskel and Ebert. They saved the day. On Sunday, we're sitting there, got bad reviews, didn't open, and they gave us a review. It was on Sunday morning, and they said, this is why you get into the business for movies like this. We laughed so hard, and they looked in the camera and said, guys, the guys who made this movie, I'm talking to you. Thank you. Thank you for this movie. I swear to God, it was the only thing that kept me going for 6 months.
Oh my God.
So painful. And that, by the way, the morning it opens, you get the phone call from the producer or the studio. And I'm like, well, guys, you know, it opened during the Olympics, 98. And I said, guys, well, what do you expect? You opened during the Olympics, and you have no ads on the Olympics. Because they had no ads on the Olympics. They said, well, that's not your crowd. I was like, what? The world's not our crowd? I said, guys, you know, what do you expect? You know, you didn't have as he goes, Peter, hey, look inside. It didn't work.
Oh, it didn't work.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
That's fucked up.
Yeah. But did it ever end up ultimately making money?
Monster hit on DVD and on video. It was the first movie ever to be number one on video 4 weeks in a row after never being in the top three. It was fifth its first week, and it didn't get any better than that.
Did you call that guy back and go, hey, I just looked inside, and it says, fuck you.
Yeah. No, it did great. And to this day, like, I was out with people one time a couple years ago, and they were talking about, like, Kingpin. And I said, how much do you think it made? And there was, like, four people at dinner, and they all bet, I don't know, 160, 180, 190, 220? No, 25 total.
Jeez.
You know, people forget that it didn't do well. So ultimately, you know, as an artist, if that's what we are, then, you know, the one thing you want is to be seen. You want people to see what you do. And so everyone saw it. So, you know.
It was a cultural hit, even if it didn't make $200 million. But, guys, I just feel like that movie is part of pop culture. It's not a movie that made $25 million and disappeared. I mean, it's the movie where people go, and you know, they always say the same thing when they talk about Kingpin. They're like, Kingpin, fucking Bill Murray. You know, like they always. You've literally worked with pretty much everyone, or at least most of the people that a comedy nerd would want to work with. You know, like Bill. How was Bill Murray?
Okay, this is Bill Murray. He is. When you're around Bill Murray, you're like, you can't believe how lucky you are to be around Bill Murray. You're
right.
Like, oh my God. I'm like, this guy is like, he is the funniest man on the planet, or definitely in the top three. And the energy you get from him is so alive and, you know, real. And this sense of like, this is spectacular. I can't believe he's here. And when he leaves, you're so relieved. and it's because there's an energy around him that is so strong, like that is so, like, you know, palpable, like, you know, that it is like you got to be on your game around him, because, you know, he calls you. Wait, what does that mean, Pete? Well, no, I didn't say anything. You know, Pete, I think you.
What do you think
something.
It means, Bill?
Yeah, what is that, Pete? You know, he'll call you on everything in the best way. By the way, I love Bill Murray, and he is a. But this is another thing. Bill's blue collar. He's a blue collar guy. Loves crews. Loves the crew.
Yeah.
He loves the crew. He loves everybody who works on a movie. He treats them like brothers and sisters, because that's where he came from. He's that guy. He's a blue collar guy from Chicago, but he can't stand suits. So producers and studio executives to him are worthless. He doesn't like a guy who shows up on the set in a coat and tie, and that guy should be afraid, because Bill is, he doesn't like, he, you know, it goes right down to Caddyshack. You know, he's the caddy. You know, he's the guy working on the course. He's not the club member. And the guy, when the club member shows up, there's just, you can just see Bill is not going to kiss anybody's ass.
Yeah.
And so that's where, you know, you get stories about Bill Murray being difficult. Well, that's not, I never had one bad moment with Bill Murray. He was, couldn't have been.
He's difficult if you're a suit and you're not a comedy person and you're telling him how to do comedy.
Exactly.
That's probably when he's difficult.
Yeah, exactly. But by the way, this is the other thing he did. The first day he shows up, we give him the sides, you know, which are the pages that you get every day that we're going to shoot that day. And he shows up on the set, and I said, here you go, here are your sides. And he flipped through them like in a second. Okay. Yeah, all right. And he throws it on the floor. He goes, I get it. Let me run with it. And he never said one word that was scripted, and it was 10 times better. 10 times better than anything we had written. And by the way, that's your worst nightmare, that an actor wants to take it upon themselves to make it better. We let them do that after we do what's scripted.
Sure. Yeah.
We always say, this is what I say. I say, let's do what's scripted and then let's wing it. Let's go off page. Let's find stuff.
That's the thing, too. If you ever read the shooting script for Ghostbusters, all of the great Bill Murray lines aren't in the script because he came up with all of them.
Oh, yeah.
Like every fucking great line.
You know, gravy train with biscuit wheels. You're like, where the hell did he get this? You know, just looking at the girl like, hi, not you. That's just, you know, that's not scripted. None of this is scripted. And it's way funnier than we could have ever done. So there's like a feeling when you're with Bill, it's like it's a joyful experience, and you're so alive for that time when you're with him, but it takes all your energy.
When he's like improvising in a scene or just improvising his lines, does he stay within it enough for like the other actors like Woody Harrelson to be able to respond to properly? Or do they have to then go off script?
They might have to go off a bit, but basically he's not changing who that guy is.
Yeah,
he's getting it to the thing, and he makes them better, because now there was a lot of times if you're not responding to something scripted, it's way more real, you know. So even though it's the same tone, same direction, it's funnier. It helps them. It absolutely helps them. And by the way, that's the other thing. Loves actors. Bill loves actors. He respects actors. He gives them a lot of rope, and he helps them out. You know, he's very helpful. He just doesn't like suits. If a guy shows up with a suit, I just literally say to him, you shouldn't be here. Bill's here today.
Oh, Bill's not going to like this.
Bill is not going to like you. Why? What did I do? I said, you got a tie on, man. He's going to fucking flip out.
Well, that's probably why he just has an answering machine like a voicemail service where you just pitch him stuff that you want him to do.
I loved. I saw an extended version of Kingpin where there was more scenes showing how much of a scumbag Woody Harrelson's character was.
Yeah.
What was the, like? Was it a time thing to cut those out? Like.
Yeah.
Like the money money in the convenience store. Yeah. Like that. That was like seeing that scene. I was like, oh, like it's such a simple thing that like you understand him so quickly at this point. Like where he's gotten to, what he's become. And, like, I was wondering, like, was it a time thing that cut it out, or was it just kind of a...
No, it was time thing, because, you know, it's a funny thing. It's like your song, you know, the Hard and Firm song. And the truth of the matter is this. That was a spectacular thing. And when you play it on its own, everybody's like, you'd say, why would you ever cut that? Well, the reason it was cut is because it came about 8 minutes from the end of the movie. And at that point, the audience has got this feeling like we're winding it down. And then when you start a big musical number out of nowhere, they're like, you're kidding me. if we had placed that, I learned after we did this, if we had placed that in the first act or beginning of the second act, that would have flown. That would have been great. But that's what happens. Like, you have so many jokes, and you're getting pressure from the studio to take it down because they want it shorter. You know, like, our comedies run a little longer. Like, most of them. Like, Kingpin and Dumb and Dumber, those are hour 48.
Yeah.
And
they don't feel like it.
You would expect 90 minutes from those kind of comedies. So we are already adding stuff. But the studio is like, no, this is too long for a comedy. So you find them out. Like, I remember there was one scene in that movie that just bugged me. I cut. I'm mad at myself for cutting, which was, you know, there's the thing early on where Woody's flossing. And Randy says, hey, what are you doing, Mr. Munson? He says, flossing. He says, flossing? Where did I get Munson from? He goes, no. My name's Munson, but what I'm doing is flossing. And that stayed. But later on, we had a scene where right before the big match, Woody's throwing up in the bathroom. And Randy, you know, Randy comes in and he says, what you doing, Mr. Munson? He said, barfing. He goes, where do I keep getting Munson from? and we cut it because it was at the very end. Again, it was at the very end. And it just felt, and I remember the studio saying, enough, get on with the bowling tournament, you know. But I kicked myself that I caved on that one.
And then something about Mary, is it, When you're doing that movie, was it because that really felt like, okay, how much can we get away with and still leave in the movie?
Yeah, you know, when we wrote that, we thought we thought it was, you know, we love it. If like, you know, everything we've written, you know, it's like, you know, I know they haven't all been great, by the way, but but to us, they were. It's like an artist. It's like, you know, like you look at somebody who does a painting and you say, what's your favorite painting? It's like, well, that was at that time in my life, I really wanted to do that. You know, you don't want to do the same thing over and over. But in any case, when we wrote that thing, we thought this is really hilarious, but we weren't sure if it would work because nobody had ever pushed it that way, you know, with the hair gel, for instance.
Yeah.
And the studio definitely didn't think it worked. They said, you can't do that. That's an NC-17. You're not going to do that. So, no, let's try it because we believe that, you know, that if it's for humor, it's R, and if it's for titillation, it's NC-17. We think we get through it. So it was very, very hard to make. And but the great moment that we had there was that nobody was doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody was doing that. So that's why we really snuck up on people, and that's what humor is. You know, when you surprise them, and they're thinking you're going this way, and you go that way. You know, and you can't do that so much anymore. And that's why we kind of did get away
from that. That's so funny to me, because that's so funny that they were nervous about that, because once the movie hit and did well, I remember, maybe it was when the DVD came out, or the VHS at that time. I guess DVDs that time, too. But as part of the ad campaign, they were like, and it'll have you asking the question, what's that in her hair? Yeah. And all of the spots advertising it had the hair.
There's
and
something
so,
about that hair.
So it's really funny that they, you know, I mean, again, it's just, you know, the studios, they're capitalists. So if they go, oh, it worked. All right, now let's do all cum hair jokes.
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, that's where we get the gross out thing, which was always troubling to us. I hate that term gross out guys, because it wasn't funny because it was gross. It was, you know, I've seen gross. Like, there are movies where people are just gross, and that was funny because it was an elaborate setup that led to that. You know, he hadn't seen the girl in 17 years. You know, his friend talks him into jerking off.
Yeah.
He loses the thing, which is like a very Seinfeldian thing. Like, where the hell did that go? What happened to it? It ends up in his ear.
George, where's the cum? Did you see where the cum went?
Jerry, I just found some cum in my apartment.
Exactly. It ends up in his ear. Then she's like, what is it? He comes up with the idea. It's hair gel. Then you cut the later. It's an elaborate thing. It's not just gross. And for critics to simplify it and say, oh, it's gross out comedy, is like, you don't understand comedy. It's so much more than
that. The mechanism of it wasn't just to show cum. The mechanism was he really likes this girl and he wants the date to go well, and something horribly awkward happens and he still has to go on the date and he doesn't want to ruin it. I mean, like, that takes it out of gross and makes it really human.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we did it because we thought it was funny, and ultimately it worked out. But by the way, we shot it two different ways, because Cameron Diaz said, I don't know, what if this doesn't work? What if it isn't funny? And we had to agree that could happen, because it could end the movie. The girls, women in the audience say, oh, Jesus, that's horrible. And the guys would be grossed out when it's in her hair. That was a possibility. When we tested it, that didn't happen. People went through the roof. They were howling. But we shot it two ways. We shot it with the hair gel, and then we shot it. So you could have gotten around that scene if it didn't work. And that was just to protect Cameron, because we didn't want her walking down the street and have people yell, like, hey, come head! You know,
15 hey, come years. Head.
Yeah.
what was Jonathan Richman in as the kind of narrator?
Jonathan Richman.
Because he appeared in Kingpin.
I'm a huge Jonathan Richman fan. And he grew up, you know, he's from Massachusetts. And when I was a kid, we used to listen to WVBF and Jonathan Richman, the Modern Lovers, they would play. Yeah. And it was just spectacular. I always liked him. So when he came to L.A., I would always go see him. And I really liked him, and we had put him in Kingpin. And then we were watching him at a show, and we had just written something about Mary. I was with my brother, and he played a song in the show. We said, hey, that would be perfect for something about Mary. It was like, I can't remember the song, but it was something that pertained to the movie. And then he played another one that did. We said, hey, that's a good one, too, for this scene. And then my brother said, hey, wait a second. You know what? Let's pull the Cat Ballou thing. You know, do you remember Cat Ballou? They had Stubby K and Nat King Cole. He'd popping in occasionally just to, you know, fill you in.
Well, like a Greek chorus, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, they went to the store. Yeah. And, Greece, that would be the technical term, yes, a Greek chorus.
it gave that movie such a fresh spine.
Yeah.
And something like really fun to keep going back to, just like wraparounds. I don't know. It was a really, all the elements of that were so much fun. And you know, you've, you guys clearly have an eye for, you know, you caught Jim Carrey at the beginning of his thing. You caught Ben Stiller right before. Like, that was kind of right around when Ben Stiller broke. Because before that, he was a funny guy that some people remembered from the Ben Stiller show.
And he was doing dark indie movies.
Well, not just dark indie movies, but he popped up in Happy Gilmore for a minute.
Heavyweights.
He was a funny guy that would pop up in movies, but was not really a star at that point.
By the way, you know who it came down to for that movie? For Ben Stiller's role, it came down to Ben Stiller, Owen Wilson, John Stewart.
Oh, shit.
Oh, wow.
John Stewart was very, very, very close to being the guy. He was spectacular. Very close to
being
the guy.
Oh, man, I'm going to jerk off before I go on this date, man. Yeah.
That's my Owen Wilson. That's my John Stewart. Yeah.
Hey, welcome to the Daily Show, man.
That was not as good as your Owen Wilson.
What part of our history leads you to believe you're jerking off in a movie, Peter?
What were we saying right before that? I wanted to tell you something.
We're talking about Greek choruses.
The first time we tested that movie, I was sitting behind a row of African-American women. They were sitting right in front of me. They were all like 21, 22 years old. And it starts with Jonathan Richman in the tree. You pan along, and he's starting to sing this song. And this girl, and I was sitting there all nervous, you know, how's this going to go? And this woman looks at her friend, and she goes, "This is bullshit." Swear to God. I was like, okay, well, we're going to have to cut Jonathan.
Yeah.
And then the next time he came up, she kind of giggles. And by the end, every time he comes up, she loved it. And that woman wanted over. You know, I was literally going to cut the thing. I thought, okay, this isn't working right away. You know, this is a nightmare.
When they're filling out the forms, it's like, excellent, good, fair, unsatisfactory. This is bullshit in all caps.
Wraps around the page.
But movie 43.
Yes.
We should talk about for a minute.
That's a good idea.
Now, I knew about this movie because Charlie Wessler reached out quite a few years ago now and said, you know, we're going to do this like sketch movie. And I pitched him a couple ideas and nothing ever worked out. But I've been aware of it for a really long time. So I'm glad that it finally got made. But you guys got huge people.
Well, you know, it's an interesting movie because it wasn't shot. It's a $6 million budget. So we didn't have a lot of dough. And Charlie wanted all these superstars, who he eventually got. So the way he would do it, and the way he got them, by the way, because Charlie is the guy who could call actors. He actually knows everybody in town. He's sort of like a Zelig type character. Yeah. He was a PA on Empire Strikes Back. You know, he's been around forever. He knows everybody. So he literally would call people like Richard Gere and say, "Hey, Richard, we're doing this like sketch movie. You want to be in? I'll send you a thing." And Richard would read it. So "I'd love to, but I'm working for the next year." He goes, "Well, when are you available?" He goes, "A year from April." He goes, "We'll wait, and we'll go to you." And he did that. He shot 3 days here, closed down for 6 months. 3 days there, because it was all different directors, all different crews, all different actors, and it took 3.5 years to make the movie. By the way, that's another thing that the New York Post woman twisted. This movie's been on the shelf for 3.5 years.
Oh, that sucks.
That production.
No, it took 3.5 years to make the movie.
If it makes you feel any better, she's probably really unhappy in life.
Yeah, yeah.
Why do I feel better about it?
That's true.
And you got James Gunn is one of the directors there and there. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, we're just sensational people, but this is the hardest R movie you will see this year, without question. It is, like people say, well, do you have, like, you know, it's a Charlie Wessler movie. It was his baby. I directed two of the shorts. There are 15 different directors. There's a bunch of different writers, all different actors. And but we really, really push it. And people are like, do you have a little, like, the heart that you have in there? No heart. there's no heart at all. It's just for laughs. It's like what you'd see on Funny or Die, except there's no, you know, there's a ceiling on Funny or Die.
Well, but like Kentucky Fried Movie, Amazon Women on the Moon, like, it's a sketch movie. It's the thing that the Zucker Brothers did so beautifully. And then I can't think of any other really big sketch movies since the early 80s.
Well, there's been like elements of sketch, like, you know, UHF is kind of a sketch movie.
Yes, exactly.
Sort of, but that at least
Kids in
that
Hall,
had
Brain
a
Brain Candy.
But Brain Candy and UHF's definitely, like, there was still a through line.
Yeah,
there is a through line in this, too.
Oh, there is.
Yes, there is, because actually...
I rescind my comment.
No, we tested it without the through line. We did it both ways. We tested it with just the shorts. And you can't do it today. The world's attention spans have shrunk. And basically, if you're an hour and 5 minutes into a movie and you're starting a new short... People are looking at their watches like, do I want to start another one?
Yeah, because they can reset.
Yeah. And so what we do is we have this thing where Dennis Quaid is a down-and-out producer, and he's pitching these projects to his studio head, Greg Kinnear and Common. Mm-hmm. And as he's going along, Seth MacFarlane's in there as well, by the way, at the studio, and there's these things that he runs into. But as he starts pitching these projects that are people, you know, other writers have written that he's representing, and he starts pitching them, and as it goes on, he starts getting more and more desperate, so that you want to see what he's going to do. He starts getting crazy
toward the
end, and that's the through line that pulls you along.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. And then when does the movie come out?
It comes out Friday.
Friday. Okay, this Friday. What date is that? The 25th. Yeah,
yes.
Friday.
And by the way, just so to be clear, it's going to get about a 4 on Rotten Tomatoes, because it is so... seriously, it is so outrageous. Like, it is... this is an odd movie to test. When we tested it, it didn't test well. It did like 55 or 60, which is not great. It's not, you know, but the 55 or 60 who loved it, they were carrying us out of the theater. They literally, like, I've never come out of a theater where you had like 40 people hanging around and they're coming up like, hey, dude, I just want to tell you, you can't cut this part. You got to keep this. This is fucking hilarious, you know. And then other people would be like, that's ridiculous. It's so pushed that it's not going to be for everybody, and mainly it's not going to be for critics. They're not going to they're going to just not embrace a movie like this. But I promise you guys, like, going back to something about Mary, you will get a massive kick out of this thing. It's really a very, very funny movie. Anybody in their teens, 20s, 30s, 40s, and as I say, anybody who still smokes weed in their 50s should step in and go. It's for those people.
Well, I'm excited to see the movie, and I just because I've been aware of it for so long, and I'm so excited to see like how it panned out. But you've always been such a nice guy. Like, you're a guy that, and someone else said, oh yeah, Pete just has a mind like this. But you know, I met you when you came on to promote something about Mariana radio station, and then like 6 years later, I ran into you, and you're like, hey Chris, how's it going? Remember we did the radio thing? It's me, Pete. Like, you were explaining to me who you were. I'm like, no, Pete, I know who you are. I am surprised that you remember me.
Okay, this is the guy's honest truth. I actually do not have a good brain, like, for that. My wife is, she's the brain. Whenever we go anywhere, I'm like, who's this? That was a particularly memorable interview that you guys did. I remember you from that. I remember hanging up saying, who are those guys? They're funny fuckers. Like, we had a lot of laughs on that interview.
That was fun.
That's why I remember that. Because I really am not that good at that. I'm terrible at it. Actually.
Because I was dating a girl at the time who was... who was friends with Gary Valentine, who I also knew from doing stand-up, who's Kevin James's brother.
Right.
And we were at a party, like a New Year's Eve party or something, at Kevin's house, and you were there.
Uh-huh.
And that was like 6 years after that, 5 years after that interview, and that's when you remembered me. And I remember saying to my girlfriend at the time, like, how the fuck does he remember that? It was like one interview that he must have done out of a million.
Yeah, but I also knew you before that, because you used to host a show, a TV show,
I did, yeah.
Yeah, and I remembered you from that. Like, when we did the radio thing, I mean, you're the Chris Hardwick who did, what was the show you did? It was a dating show? Or something.
It was Jean-Paul Sartre's Singled Out.
Yeah, because I remembered you for that. So, yes, we go way back.
But it's always, you know, there really is something about this business where, you know, it's a long business. Hopefully you have a long career. And the people that are nice to work with, you always root for them. You always want them to do well. You always really enjoy seeing them. And you're definitely one of those people. And it really does... You know, I'm sure you've worked with people who are dickheads before, and you don't have to say who, but, you know, people who are dickheads, the first opportunity that someone has to not work with you, they will not work with you because it is not fun to work with dickheads.
Yeah. Well, that's a truth, but we haven't worked with real dickheads because I literally call around. Like, we've been down to like 3 or 4 people for, like, I remember this one role we were casting women, and there were 3 or 4 actresses, and they were completely equal. Like, you could take any of them, and they were all excellent. And we just called everybody working in the last movie, say, what were they like? And I swear to God, 2 of them, the people said, fucking nightmare. And one of them said, angel. And that's the one we hired, you know? And the others will never know. That's why they didn't get it. You know, they were just... We avoid
it. Way to do it.
Yeah.
Good. That stuff follows you around.
Yeah.
The people talk. Crews talk.
Yeah.
Craft service people talk. PAs talk. PAs become producers. Like, and not that that's a reason that you should be nice to people, but if you have a tendency toward dickheadedness, at least try to latch on to something that makes you nice to people.
Yeah, but I have to say this also. Like, I've met people who have, like, terrible reputations or had terrible reputations who I couldn't have been nicer. You know, like, absolutely. Like, we worked with Alec Baldwin. We produced a movie outside Providence with Alec Baldwin. And he was coming off, like, basically every studio in town were saying, I'm not working with this guy. He's just, he's out of control. The nicest guy we ever worked with. Like, just a prince of a guy who, we had a low budget. We had nothing. He was the guy who was, like, coming early, hanging in late, helping out, you know, so it's surprising, like, you know, a lot of times you do kind of get, you know, you have one bad day. It's like a restaurant. You have one bad day and that could follow you and it might not be accurate.
Or, you know, Alec Baldwin also seems like a guy because he's pretty fucking smart.
Yeah.
That probably has the same Bill Murray thing where it's the studio heads. Where he just, they just rub him the wrong way, you know, like studio people just rub him the wrong way.
Well, he's got his opinions, so he
does have his opinions.
Yeah, but they're good opinions.
Would you ever do another movie that was as kind of personal as Outside Providence?
Well, I wrote a book called The Comedy Writer, which is talk of doing into a movie, which is semi autobiographical. You know, it's you know, based on my when I moved out to L.A. But it's not, it's completely true. People say, "Wow, this happens." No, that didn't happen. That's fictional. That's why it's called a novel. You know, it's not an autobiography. But yeah, I would do something. But I wouldn't want to. You see, like I didn't do Outside Providence. I wrote the screenplay and handed it over to Michael Careni. And he did a great job. And I wouldn't want to direct Comedy Writer, but if someone else did, somebody who I really admired, I would definitely cut it loose. Otherwise, I have no interest in having it made. Really, I don't care if it gets made. But if someone impressive came along and said, I'd like to do it, I said, God bless it. Go ahead. Here, just give me $1. You got all the rights.
I like to ask writers this question, which is, you know, how do you get past the wall? Or it's just that where you have those days or time periods where you're just like, you're staring at final draft or whatever you're writing on and goes, nothing. There's just fucking nothing. Like, how do you get past those?
We get that all the time. And what it is you just don't stop. Like, you know, when we start writing a screenplay, we have 2 weeks of that. You know, where you sit there the first day, like, sitting around, like, hey, you see the game? What happened? What was Brady doing, by the way? You know. And, you know, I Belichick, he kind of blew it at the end of the first half. What's he not calling timeout?
Yeah, I know.
Fucking
ridiculous.
I know. And so you do that.
Why did he stop? He had that on third down.
Matt, he was just using it as a hypothetical. It was just an example on the story.
Damn it.
I'm in pain from that, by the way.
Me
too. You have a few days talking about that shit, and then, you know, someone reading the paper, and then someone this, and laughing, and telling jokes, inside things. And then finally, after 2 weeks, somebody said, hey, what the fuck are we doing? We got to work, you know? And so we get going. And then along the way, you hit these big things that would be called writer's block. You know, people, like, say, do you ever get writer's block? You say, well, that's the whole process of writing. For me, I mean, it's like overcoming that thing where you've got nothing, and you're sitting there, and I find if you don't quit, it's going to come. It may take a day, may take a week, may take a month. And when it gets really bad, we get in the car. This is what we do. We get in the car and we drive. I'll drive cross country. I've done it 22 times, by the way.
Jesus
cross
Christ.
Country. And we just go. And my wife knows it. She'll, when we're struggling and I'm coming home, I get nothing today, nothing again. She goes, just go somewhere. I'll get in the car and I will drive straight to Canada, to Vancouver and back. By the way, just to, something about being in a car for me. And it is, first of all, you're locked in with the other guy. Okay, there's not none of that timeout, phone calls, all this stuff. We don't take cell phones. I don't have a cell phone. Never had a cell phone. And we don't take any of that stuff. And you go along, and you're just talking. And also, when you're in a car, you can't do this sitting on a couch. Because when you're sitting on a couch, part of your brain is thinking, you could be making those calls right now, or you could be doing dishes, or you could be cleaning that up, or what about your kid's school, or, you know, all these things that you can be doing. But when you're driving, you're doing the only thing you can do, and driving second nature. You don't have to think about driving. So basically you're doing it without thinking of it, and it frees your mind to think clearly. Like, and it doesn't happen the first hour or 2 hours. It happens after, like, 12 hours for me, or 16 hours, or even
when you
like,
hit Salem, Oregon.
No, even 3 days. And I get into a thing. I've never done TM, but it, what I read about it, that's exactly the state. You get into a state of like transcendental meditation where all of a sudden everything is clear and it's so obvious. It's like, oh, fuck, how could I have not seen it? But by the way, the first thing I do when I get in a car, first thing, when we're driving along, I know I'm giving you a very long-winded
This is
answer.
A great fucking answer.
First thing I do is the first day, I have a pad next to me, and when I'm driving, I start thinking of things that are gnawing at me. Like, you know, I haven't talked to my sister Kathy in like 3 weeks. Call Kathy. Write it down. Do this. Hey, you know, your roommate from college. I got to check in. You know, did I ever send this guy? You know, this thing. Things that you've been putting off that you haven't done that are gnawing at you, that making you feel not good. That just bugging you, you know, like you, guilt.
Yeah.
Guilt things. And you write a whole page until they're all done, all out of your head. And you know, well, I'm going to do those things now. I've made a list of them. And every one of those things I will do when I get home. And I do. I get home, I go right down the list and cover all those things. But I've freed my brain up. I've taken them out of my head now. And then that's where the clarity
That is
begins.
The fundamental. That is one of the fundamental principles of, and not to make everything sound too businessy, but that's, there's a guy named David Allen who wrote a book called Getting Things Done. And I used a lot of those principles when I started getting organized, and certainly some of them popped up in my book too. But it's basically, he calls that closing loops. You have to pull all of your thoughts into the physical universe and then just deal with them. Just deal with them. Like, just doing something with them gets them out of your head. It's exactly what you just said. Good. And also the idea, I love the idea of when you don't have something to write about, you stimulate your brain by changing your environment and putting new stuff into your brain, and that kind of gets everything moving. This is driving. This is a fun, I'm actually going to try this. It's a really fantastic idea. I tend to go crazy on cross country trips after about the third day. Like, I'm stranded. I'm in a prison. I'm in a metal box prison.
Yeah.
Because there is literally, you get into the middle of the country, and if your car stopped, you would just be there.
Yeah. Well, the first 2 days are the hardest for me because every time
forever
first 2 days I'm doing it, I'm like, what the fuck are you doing? Why are you doing this again? You have so far to go, and it's so boring at first.
No cell phone, too, Pete. Yeah. What are you? How are you? You're going to die out there with no cell phone.
But you push through it. You get past
okay.
it.
All right, it's
and,
okay.
And it does make it better.
Okay, good.
But this is what happens, by the way, writer's block, how we get over it. Like, you're focusing on a scene. Okay, these guys go to a, they stop into a bar. What's going to happen in the scene? By the way, we wrote Dumb and Dumber 2, which we hope to make this summer with Jim and Jeff again.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, we're very close to making an announcement. I can't make it on this show, but I hope to make it in the next couple weeks.
Okay.
Cool. We're very close, but we took a long time to write this script. We busted our ass, and we want it because it's a high level. You know, by the way, just to be clear, we didn't do Dumb and Dumberer.
No,
okay.
A Troy Miller joint.
But we really, we didn't want to make Dumb and Dumber 2 unless it can be as, like, Dumb and Dumber. And so we really busted our balls. But you drive along and you're thinking, you know, they're in the bar, what happens at the bar? And then somebody says something dumb, like, you know, just in talking about something else, somebody says something really stupid, and you say, that, you know, that's something they could say. And then all of a sudden, you start making lists of dumb things like that. And then all of a sudden, it just takes off into a way you weren't expecting it to go. Like, you know, we made lists of, like, dumb expressions. Like, you know, even a blind squirrel's right twice a day. You know, like that's something they'd say, you know. Like, and then you say, what else would they say like that? And all of a sudden, you've come up like things like that. And then you come in sideways.
Yeah.
You find out that the way you've been thinking of it is wrong. You're looking at it at the wrong angle. You have to come in from another side.
Well, it's also, I mean, it's like, you know, for me, the stand-up that works the most, the best, is stuff that just sort of happens in the moment, not the stuff where I'm sitting at a computer going, and then I say this.
Oh, yeah.
And then here's the kicker, you know? Yeah. It's always that sort of in the moment, like, oh, yeah, this is this is a very organic experience that's happening, and your brain kind of finds those
Absolutely.
Answers.
Absolutely. It's more real, and that's why you go out, you go to a party or something, you write down a couple things, and those are the best ones, yeah. as opposed to sitting at a desk thinking of jokes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're at the end of our hour, but I don't know why that sounded like therapy all of a sudden. Peter, we're at the end of our hour.
Well, we're just about out. Okay.
But I love having you on the show, and I would love to have you come back if you want to. Just fuck around.
It'd be my pleasure.
Next time we can talk about the comedy writer. I mean, there's so many different things that that you have that I think are relevant to anyone with, particularly with a comedy nerd brain?
Well, thanks. I love being here. I'd do it anytime.
All right. We'll talk about Wes Welker and what the fuck's going on.
I can't go there because I'm in too much pain. I need a few days.
What's that? What are you talking about?
Patriots. Fucking that game on Sunday.
What happened?
They lost.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But did the other team win?
Yep. That's how it works.
Oh.
I wouldn't say the other team won. I say we lost.
I love this. There's an old Jeff Stilson bit. Did you know Jeff Stilson, stand-up comic?
No.
I think, does Jeff write for like Letterman? Or like he was a stand-up in the 80s that I loved, and he had this really dry sense of humor. And he was like, how come sports stars always thank God whenever they win, but the losers always blame themselves? Just once, I like to see someone go, yeah, we were playing a pretty good game out there until Jesus made me fumble.
That's funny.
So I fucking love that bit. It's about as sportsy as I get.
Yeah.
It's good.
But I guess the Super Bowl is coming up.
Yeah, February 3rd.
Which is the day that our PBA, I bowled in the celebrity tournament.
Oh, really?
And
are you good at bowling because your dad was a bowler?
I'm pretty good. I'm not going to lie.
What's your high?
He's well at bowling.
what's your all-time high? 279?
My all-time high is 289.
289.
But I was 11 when I bowled it. It was 10 strikes in a row, and then I left it.
There was bumpers up.
Bumpers at that time. And then I left a 10-pin. It was 10 strikes in a row and then a 10-pin.
Ooh.
Fucking, it crushed me. I almost had it. And I've never, and then I kind of quit bowling after I was 13 and just picked it back up again in the last year or so. But the fact that I've never bowled a perfect game is gets under my skin. And then my half-brother, who lives in Tennessee, just bowled a perfect game. He got to it first, and he's sort of a casual bowler. And he got to it first. So I credit my brother, Eddie Hardwick. Is an actual person.
I like
person.
The idea of a 14-year-old washed-up bowler, you.
Yeah. You guys don't even know. Get the fuck out of here.
Drinking sarsaparilla at the bar.
Hey, Chris, I'm not that 10-pin. You fucking get out of my
You just start inhaling the whatever they wax the floor with.
Yeah.
The climactic scene in Kingpin where Bill Murray had to have three strikes in a row. We were figuring that's going to take some time. But we had, by the way, 1,500 people in we shot it in Reno, Nevada at the bowling center.
Silver Legacy.
Yeah. And we explain he has to get three, strikes. So we're going to keep going until he gets three. He gets first time, boom, strike. Second time, boom, strike. Third time. The fucking place erupts.
Oh, my God, of course.
Three in a row. Bill Murray strikes the first three he tries. And that's why that crowd goes out of their mind. They couldn't believe how
fucking
because they'd seen Woody Bowl and it wasn't pretty.
That is so Bill Murray.
I need you now. More than ever.
Yeah. Well, Pete, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Chris.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Gen Z high school girls have gone through a lot. So what could and did send a shockwave through a group of 50 of them competing in one of the nation's biggest scholarship competitions? I'm your host, Shimo Liai, and I'm going to take you behind the scenes of the Distinguished Young Women Competition. I was Nevada's competitor 20 years ago, but this time, a Supreme Court decision catapults all 50 girls into the center of a nationwide debate about their rights. These girls, who have spent months fighting to make it to nationals, are faced with a tough decision. Do they speak up for their political beliefs, or do they stay focused on winning the money?
I think it's going to get ugly.
Follow the competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of the competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.